Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. Hope you have a great three-day weekend. If you remember what weekends are all about, we won't have a podcast on Monday. And really, I'm kind of hoping not to even have a newsletter on Monday, although there are so many things going on. And I always worried that that we'll have 3 days worth of really interesting stuff that I have to catch up on Tuesday. So no promises, but don't be shocked. And by the way, if you have not subscribed to one of our newsletters, they are free and they're going to remain free. So we have new polls out. We have clear new signals about reopening America. We're going to reopen America no matter what happens. President essentially saying, if we have a second wave of this, basically, screw it. we're staying open. The president did not, of course, wear a mask in public yesterday at Ford, but there are pictures of him wearing a mask, which I find to be a very, very interesting moment, as if it actually mattered. Speaking of things that matter, just to chew over all of this stuff, we are joined by one of our most popular guests on the Bulwark Podcast, Mike Murphy, who... What, Mike, you just go by political guru? Is that on the business card?
Yeah. Grifter, furious Republican consultant has been. I wear a lot of hats, but yeah, I just do Republican strategist or enraged Trump hater, either one.
Well, let's just start with what a terrible day snake oil is having. Because I don't want to gloss over this. So here's the lead in the Washington Post story. A study of 96,000 hospitalized coronavirus patients. Now, by the way, we had lots of studies, and there's studies showing this and studies showing that, and you always have to look at is it a really big study or is it 8 people living in a commune in Berkeley who eat something or do something. 96,000 is a big ass study. So this is 96,000 hospitalized coronavirus patients on 6 continents. Study found that those who received an anti-malarial drug promoted by President Trump as a game changer in the fight against the virus had a significantly higher risk of death compared with those who did not. Wow. So people treated with hydroxychloroquine or the closely related drug chloroquine were also more likely to develop a type of irregular heart rhythm or arrhythmia that can lead to sudden cardiac death, it concluded. So in fairness, Trump said it was a game changer, and death is kind of the ultimate game changer, right?
I would say so. You know, it is. Well, Trump's going to disqualify the study because those so-called doctors forgot to coat the medicine in Clorox before anybody took it, which is, of course, the missing ingredient, or swallow a string of UV Christmas tree lights and count to 10. So, yeah, you know, it's sad because at a time like this, people want crutches and saying, hey, we can use this drug off-label and everything's right. I mean, they've known from the beginning, and every doc, I talked to my doc about it, and he says, well, look, you got malaria. It was state-of-the-art treatment in 1969, but it does interfere with your heart rhythm. You know, that's a well-known side effect. So this is like, it's the whole Trump versus science, creating his own reality bubble. And I've always thought, watching him during this, that Trump really wants to be respected as a doctor. You know, he's had these moments where he starts going into it where, I'm busy being the president genius, but I could have had a career in medicine. So it's just madness and it's tragic.
Well, I know it's also part of this, and we've talked about this before, this bizarre tribal signaling of wearing a mask or what drugs you take or touting. And at a time when you would think that this would be the moment that the world would go, hey, facts actually matter. Credibility matters. We really ought to listen to the experts. You know, maybe an indication of just sort of how deep the rot is that not even at this moment do we have people going, yeah, maybe we got to get this right.
Yeah, this is one of the most troubling things about it. The tribalism is trumping like science and fact now. You know, I'm all for a politics of disagreement, but we ought to have common facts. And the fact that voodoo potions now can be something we fight over, or people run around and say, I don't need a mask. I'm no snowflake. You know, take a shot at me, germs. Germs haven't heard of the Second Amendment. You know, it's just... It's just incredibly stupid. But, you know, maybe this is the stupid decade, and Trump is the poster freak for it.
You know, my opinion of human nature, my faith in humanity was pretty shaky before I've seen some of these videos. I don't know if you've seen them online, you know, of people who are asserting their, you know, don't tread on me rights to go into a Walmart or a Costco without wearing a mask. And it's a bizarre moment that it's become performative Trumpism to behave in the least responsible manner, which continues to blow my mind, because you would think that if you are in Trump world and you want to reopen America and you are not going to close America again, you would want people to at least send out the signal that they're not going to behave, you know, like a tribe of horses' asses.
Yeah,
right?
I mean, what we're learning from that hated science is you can reopen America if you're smart about reopening it. You know, that's the whole thing. And social distancing and masks and the way you can rebuild a manufacturing plant, all this stuff is how you reopen. You know, so it's just it's exhaustingly stupid. I have a friend who says the great unwritten part of the Bill of Rights is every American has a right to be an utter moron, too. And, you know, there we are. We're operating that way with a lot of these people. But it's a feedback loop, because it does, as you say, it becomes kind of a tribal fetish. And then it's a competition to who can be more pure in their stupidity to show nobody wearing a bow tie on television and went to so-called medical school is going to tell me nothing. And, of course, with the Joker King as president, it legitimizes stupidity. That's the real problem. Trump, you know, speaks in stupidity. Everything is anecdotal. There's no objective evidence. Contempt for learning. I mean, there was a great story in the Post about the nightmare they have trying to brief him on foreign policy, because playing with desk toys and, you know, I mean, it is.
Well, and he's unashamed about interrupting. He's unashamed about interrupting the intelligence briefer to say something that he's heard from Chris Ruddy or who else? Gary Player, the former golfer. It's like, well, you know, thank God that, well, first of all, thank God Gary Player is still alive, because I wasn't really sure about that, but that he's advising the president of the United States on foreign policy. What could go wrong?
Yeah, it's a total, you know, the inbox is open to anybody, because Trump just responds to, you know, gossip or whatever. And, you know, these poor national security professionals are there. And, you know, he's been tough on that community to begin with, no respect for it at all. And I would have loved, and because I know this day happened, to have been a fly on the wall in one of those briefings where trying to explain, well, we think there's a real tension in the Taiwan Strait, the new Chinese admiral in charge of their fleet. And yeah. What I want to know about is the aliens. You got a skull or something I can see? Where's the underground base? You know, I want to talk to one of those guys. They got condos on Jupiter. Trying to keep a straight face walking through, you know, whatever crank thing of the day he interrogates the poor briefer on. Apparently he's been through a couple of them. You know, these hardened CIA officers who'd seen it all, you know, the one thing they can't take is dealing with his briefings after a week, because it's so terrifying, the utter stupidity and avarice.
As you point out, though, he's a vector for it, and you know the tweets this week where he's threatening to retaliate against Michigan for sending out the mail-in ballots, which of course was ludicrous because they were applications. There was nothing illegal about it. A lot of states have done it. Yada yada yada. We've done all this. Tim Alberta, who lives in Michigan now from Politico magazine, has a really, I would say, scary piece. He went to a Trump tailgate, and it's got a great, the headline is Spiked Slurpees, Culture Wars, and the Coronavirus Hoax. And he has this paragraph, which sort of jumped out at me. Having obsessively covered the Republican Party from the ground up over the past decade, from the twilight of George W. Bush through the first term of Donald Trump, I thought I had seen it all, heard it all. But this was new. The warp speed at which alarms about voter fraud and specifically voting by mail were synchronized from the president's Twitter feed to the lips of his voters guarantees a volatile 5 months ahead and a potentially volcanic period thereafter. So for Tim Alberta to say he thought he'd seen it all and he was surprised is striking. But you know, you and I, we watch how this stuff spreads through conservative media. And I guess I'm not that shocked, you know, how rich the field is to convince people that, yeah, vote by mail is part of a Democratic plot to steal the election.
Well, I mean, there's such corrosive, you know, cynicism. And, you know, you saw it on the left with Bush, blood for oil. That's what it's all about. You know, they're activists on either ideological side, or I wouldn't even say if Trump is ideological, it's more of a cult of personality slash populism. He's more Juan Perón than anything else. But they need chew toys to believe in, you know, simple unified field theories. And Trump is very good. I mean, he's feeding his troops now. Obamagate, that's the real topic. The political, and of course they lap it up because it reinforces their reality. And now they've got Fox News and the internet to, you know, reinforce it. And there's a mirror thing on the left in the Bernie world. I'll be not quite as toxic as the Trump stuff, which is somebody who's still a right-winger and doesn't like a lot of the grinding of the left, is kind of stunning to me. But politically, one thing you got to remember is that politics, you know, first there's the population. Then you get people who are registered to vote, subset, huge one, but subset. Then you get the people who are registered to choose to vote. It shrinks a little more, still a lot of people. But then in each party, you get these clumps of identification, people who, I'm a Chevy driver, I'm always Chevy, I'm always a Republican, or I'm a Ford driver, I'm always a Democrat. Then within that group, you get even smaller to activists who actually vote in primaries. Then you get even smaller to people who show up to drink Spike Slurpees and you know, trade cartridge stories and complain about whatever. So they're the hobbyist class of politics. So the one, and I'm a huge Tim Alberta fan, but you got to be careful, because when you go to the self-selectors, the guys wearing the Uncle Sam suits with the camouflage top hat and everything, you're in the hobbyist class. And they aren't necessarily the same, but they're close to the primary voter class, which again is not the same as people who, yeah, I'm a Republican, and they pull the lever. So there's some data, both private and a little bit of public, mostly private, rolling around that really shows among Republicans, which are not the people in the monster trucks with the Slurpees talking to Tim at the Trump rally, but among the larger Republican tribe, there's about 1 out of 5, a little more than 20%, that are showing more and more tremendous uneasiness and even hostility to Trump. And the problem is, when you run a campaign, particularly on the Republican side, because there are less Republicans than Democrats now, demographically, you got to get them all. You want 93% of them. And if you're really, you know, under the surface doing high 70s to 80, even though it looks like you got them all, that is a huge crack in the key beam of the building. So, you know, as stuck as it all is, and as much as we fetishize, sorry to go on so long about this, but about the activists we can find because they show up and scream at the media, the larger stuff you find through polling, because people don't come to meet reporters, they're in their houses or whatever. And, you know, Trump's really, really, he's been in some trouble since the beginning, but he's made it so much worse in the last 125 days.
Yeah, let's talk about that. We have this new Fox News poll out. And of course, Trump was already unhappy with Fox News before this, you know, putting out a tweet saying Fox News isn't doing enough to help me get reelected, which, of course, is an interesting commentary on what he thinks.
Yeah, huge tell. He thinks. Come on. The whole world is bent, and you're my bent journalist. So get on with it.
Exactly.
You know, everything he presumes corruption or, you know, a bias. It's incredible.
Well, yeah, and it is that projection. So they have the new Fox News poll showing him down by 8 points nationally. But, you know, let's set that aside. I just think some of these other numbers are interesting. Voters trust Biden to do a better job than Trump on health care by 17 points. Not that surprising. Coronavirus by 9. Relations with China by 6. Trump is still trusted more on the economy by a slim 3-point margin. I don't know. My gut tells me that might be a little shaky.
Yeah, you know, that's a great point, and that is the thing I went to right in this poll. So the last big poll that I paid a lot of attention to, I don't know, maybe a month ago, was the NBC News Wall Street Journal poll. It's done by two pretty good political firms, so it's pretty solid numbers. And it was a similar kind of thing where Trump was losing everything, but he was winning the economy, perception being reality in politics, by 8 points. Now we've had a big lunge to almost within the margin, and I'll put a shameless plug in here on Hacks on Tap, where Axelrod and I talk about politics every week, our little podcast. We talk a lot about, can Biden move the economy number? Because if he can, and the campaign has started trying to, the last big ad blast was about he screwed up public health, he's going to screw up the economy. If they take that away and beat it to a draw, which in these numbers they always are, they really have the proverbial Tony Soprano hefty bag over Trump's head squeezing away the oxygen. So these are terrible numbers for Trump, not just in the horse race, but in the perception. Because once you get in a hole like that, you see, one of the things you learn in campaigns is when people think that, you know, Senator Bag of Donuts is lousy on one thing, you have fertile ground to argue, huh, not only bad on crime, don't get him started on how horrible he is on, you know, mm-hmm. job creation or taxes. It's easy to move sideways. So the one little bright star Trump had, the economy, at least in these numbers, but it's a trend we've seen, it is dimming to, you know, equivalent blackness to everything else, which is why you see a Biden sitting almost double digits ahead of him. It's bad news for the Trump guys.
Well, and also because you know that you're going to get a summer's worth of really bad numbers on the economy. There might be a bounce back in the fall, but my memory, and you correct me on this, remember when George H.W. Bush was running for re-election, the economy was already starting to come back, and there was some data, but nobody believed it, nobody felt it. Yep. And you had Bill Clinton going around saying this is the worst economy in 50 years, which was an incredible exaggeration, but it was effective. So do voters, parse that out for me. In October, it's 15% unemployment, but things are moving in the right direction. Trump get credit for that, or does he get the blame for the number?
Traditionally, you get blame. People don't vote on the economic statistics, so that does drive the media coverage, which does affect what they perceive as what's going on. But they generally react to their own situation. And what we've had for a while, even with the good economy before the coronavirus, was real wages had been flat for most people for over a decade. So even though everybody was telling them things were good and asset prices were pumping up, so the stock market, housing, in terms of what their paycheck bought, it wasn't so great and it wasn't getting better. So there was this perception gap. Now the economic pain is definite and worse, and that's always bad for an incumbent, and it tends to lag. Even when things come back, the perception, the pain tends to linger. So that was a real problem for George H.W. Bush, and I was around that campaign in 92. Mm-hmm. It was a lot less fun than 88, where, you know, it wasn't another campaign I was around where we weren't on defensive all the time. So for Trump, it's particularly tricky because Trump is, of course, a grievance politician. He needs something to be against. He's much better saying, oh, these jerks in Washington in the swamp. Oh, my God, I'm going to sort them out, you know, et cetera, et cetera. But now that he's in charge of things, he has to still run against that which he is the king of. And it's a very hard position for him. So he's trying to find things to be against. Now, the key for Trump is to change the subject of the election from fire him, which is where the country's been for a while, by the way. I mean, show me a Republican victory since the day Trump took the oath of office. We got wiped out in the Congress. We've lost 10 governorships or 11, whatever the final. I keep forgetting the exact number. As specials, we got clobbered. You know, even places like northern Wisconsin, where we just had a special election. Of course, we won our seat, but we underperformed the Republican number. So, you know, there's this fire Trump impulse, and Trump's got to change the subject to Biden. And he's kind of like the dog running on the linoleum floor. He's having real trouble getting traction. And finally, the kind of amazing thing, if you're like a historian of campaigns, is normally if you're the president and something really rough and tough happens that sustains, it's a tragic moment. But politically, it is an opportunity. Because the country wants a leader, you immediately take the pinnacle of attention, and you can do things. Trump, had he been a sane, adjusting, functional politician, could have used this virus period to actually help himself politically. I mean, look at some of these governors.
Numbers through the roof.
Fauci, numbers through the roof. Trump, numbers going down. Because Trump's the atomic clunk, the atomic clock, as I like to say, of his kind of crazy. So this spotlight has been worse for him, and it's hurt him a lot. And so he's in this hole where the only way out is to really try to make the whole thing about the failures of Biden, which is hard for an incumbent in trouble to do, but it's the classic strategy.
So as you and I are talking, of course, you know, pro-Trump and anti-Trump Twitter is going absolutely insane over, well, I mean, they're really enjoying the soundbite from Joe Biden, who was on a podcast interview, and he says, I tell you what, if you have a problem figuring out whether you're for me or for Trump, then you ain't black. I mean, it's cringy. This was on The Breakfast Club, which is a very, very popular show, that you ain't black. And of course, you know, this is launched 10,000 tweets. But as I think I said before we started all this, okay, so we're going to spend, you know, 12 hours talking about this cringy thing that, you know, that Basement Biden happened to say, and then we can get back to the hundred absurd things that Trump says every freaking day.
Yeah, I don't think it'll be material to Biden. And, you know, look, I was wrong. I kept predicting Biden would not get nominated. Simply because, and you know, ideologically, I was more comfortable with Biden than most of them. I'm still a conservative, but my priority is getting rid of Trump. But I just thought Biden didn't have the fastball for the campaign, and then he lost Iowa, he lost New Hampshire, but it was the affection and connection to African-American voters, South Carolina, as we all know, propelled him forward. What I think has changed in our politics is we've had a real trivialization of American politics for the last couple of years, Trump being the pinnacle of it, which is Washington political stuff became just more entertainment noise because the stakes were low. Economy was basically pretty good. Some concern about wages and worry in the middle class, but more or less good. And so D.C. was this sideshow on a channel of TV. On one channel, people with important-looking eyewear were complaining about people with flags behind them on the other channel, all calling names. And some guy named Bob Mueller was doing something, and Trump was an entertaining clown with a new insult. What a wild president. Blah, blah, blah. But it didn't really affect my life. And so more Washington stuff. And of course, the cable networks are great at covering trivia every day, like the biggest thing in politics, because that's their business model. Everything's the Hindenburg explosion, you know, the biggest thing in the campaign. Huge scandal. Biden today burped. But out in real world, they're doing real world things. Then we got the coronavirus. Your kids are at home. You haven't paid your mortgage in 2 months. Your brother's restaurant's going under. You don't know if you're going back to the plant. It is scary as shit. And all of a sudden, the clown on TV, who's the name-calling machine, is screwing up your life. So the stakes have gotten a lot higher. So the room to debate trivial crap, like something Biden said that was awkward, but I don't think would cost him a single African-American vote, by the way, about Trump on a radio show, which will, you know, the sirens will go off on cable TV, but out there, will it move anything? I really think not. The risk for Biden is he blows the debates because Trump's spending all this money, loopy. And one weakness the Biden campaign has is Trump campaign has a lot more money. Biden has been an anemic fundraiser. Mm-hmm. They've got independent expenditures propping them up, but you know they need money for communication. But Trump's pumping out all this Joe's a loopy idiot. Well, the great thing about the loopy idiot attack is you're the victim of it. It's very easy to knock down once you emerge on the stage by not being a loopy idiot.
Right.
So Team Biden better, you know, because Joe is a malaprop guy. The Biden guys need to get in front of this. They need to explain the first act of who Joe Biden is. There's a lot of work to be done, but it's very knockdownable. They just need to do it.
Yeah, I mean, this is of course is the opportunity that he has. You put together a few coherent, intelligent sentences, and people go, "Well, I don't see any cognitive decline there." On the other hand, during the debate, if he does get, you know, lost, it feeds into that narrative. By the way, you know,
I interrupt with a quick funny story to that point? I'll never forget. I was on the road with Dan Quayle back in the 92 reelect. I ticked somebody off at headquarters and they stuck me on the Quayle plane with Crystal and some of your other friends. We had a hell of a time and I love Quayle. So we're doing a fundraiser in North Carolina, you know, high dollar thing, somebody's big house, the plastic paper hanger king or somebody. Everything was very nice. But Tom Ellis, who had been the brains behind the Helms machine, came up to Quayle and basically said, "Mr. Vice President," and he was this old kind of Matlockian guy, although, you know, his politics were ferocious, and said, "People think you're stupid, really dumb, dumb as a box of horseshoes." You know, Quayle's standing there, you know, yeah, okay, you know. It's like Romney used to tell me, he'd go to breakfast during the campaign, you know, there'd be two a day, and people would come up, "Mitt, people think you're stiff." You know, he'd go, "Really? I hadn't heard that. Tell me more," you know, 50 times a day. But anyway, so Quayle, you're stupid. What you got to learn Russian. So when they tell you're stupid, you say some Russian at them, and nobody will say it no more, you know, which was, of course, ridiculous, but also completely on target. One or two card tricks, and you know, a perception can change. It's been set up like that because reality can burst through it. And that again is Joe's got to. He doesn't have to learn Russian, but he's got to be sharp in those debates. That'll be the key.
Yeah. Speaking of a kinder and gentler era, remember when we thought somebody was stupid because they couldn't spell potato? I mean, that seems so innocent now, right?
We've gone so far. Yeah.
Yeah. And in terms of things that matter and things that don't matter, here's a little bit of a digression. I was going through my notes and found something that I had written 3 months ago. Do you realize that 3 months ago this week was the first debate with Michael Bloomberg, the one where Elizabeth Warren just beat him over the head? That was 3 months ago. And remember what we all thought about that debate? This was just awful because the moderates are beating up on each other. You know, Klobuchar is going at it with Buttigieg, and Elizabeth Warren is ignoring Bernie, and she's just hammering the shit out of Michael Bloomberg, who was absolutely awful. Joe Biden was invisible. Nobody cared because they figured he was dead in the water. Bernie was just cruising to the nomination. That was 3 months ago this week. In fact, every time I say it, I have to count on my fingers. Okay, March, April, May. Oh, my God. Because it feels like a million years ago.
It's true. We tend to live in the moment in politics because, we have all this blaring media. Every day being covered is the biggest day in the campaign. And these things are much more logarithmic. I mean, we're going to have conventions. We're going to have a VP pick, which has very little to do with who people vote for regarding the VP, but a lot about how they perceive the candidates, the lead, you know, the nominees. Then we're going to go into the real campaign period. And then, you know, shazam, the debates and the election. So we're going to have these increasingly important spikes going forward. And a lot of this little trivia stuff is interesting, but ultimately irrelevant.
Okay, so back to this Fox poll. The other thing that jumped out at me and other folks as well is Biden's making some inroads with independents, and most interesting, voters 65 and up. This poll has him up among senior citizens by 17 points, which is stunning because that's a demographic that Trump won in 2016 by 7 points. And according to this poll, he's down 17 points among senior citizens. And that's the one demographic that always votes, always.
Yeah, it's terrifying. I mean, Mitt Romney won voters over 75, over 65. So this poll and the NBC poll before it are a snapshot of what the autopsy would look like on Trump if he's just crushed in a general election. If election were held tomorrow, Trump, they'd be wrapping him up in duct tape and taking him out of the White House. The question is, what can change? Well, in polling, you look under the surface to kind of the levers to see if you're either campaign, what you can grab onto. So if you're Biden, you're happy because you've taken his economic lead down, and that's probably going to be the most important, the comeback agenda, the most important issue in the last 60 days. So you've kind of got his head underwater there. On persona, you can see people don't trust him to do a lot. You can work with that. You can say, see, he screwed up healthcare. He screwed up this. He screwed up that. He's bad on everything. So that's the good news for the Biden people. There's no good news for Trump in this, but there are things. You know, every campaign is an effort to introduce new information. Can they move the economy number back? You know, can they get at this and say, all right, seniors have totally left us, but their natural state is to be more Republican. So can we push them back to normal Republican? You know, can there's some gravity that they will want to go back to pattern. Can we give them new information to get them there? Can we disqualify Biden among seniors? How do we do it? Et cetera, et cetera. Now, this would say that the loopy attack, which they've been working on for a while, has not worked. Seniors maybe don't like having another senior called loopy. I mean, I don't have enough crosstabs and everything to have a theory about that. But what Trump has been doing so far has not been working. If you're his campaign, you're going to look at this and try to figure it out. The problem for his campaign, when they're not figuring out what color Ferrari to order or what, you know, new condo to buy over there at Grifter Incorporated, is Trump doesn't, you know, there's nobody runs the Trump campaign but Trump. The campaign is a fundraising machine and a few ads. You know, there's no sophisticated strategic operation. It's just Trump with the biggest microphone in the world being the president, you know, yelling based on what's irritating him in any 24-hour period. So my guess, the most entertaining thing about this will be Trump going crazy on Fox News, which, of course, is ironically so delicious. And but this is a legit poll. The Fox poll has been historically legit. It's not a corrupt poll. So, and, you know, this there'll be sparks now. It'll be fun.
So what do you think is going on with senior citizens? Why has there been such a strong and rapid erosion of support. Is it about the coronavirus? Is it something else? I can throw out some theories. I mean, you know, this is a group obviously that pays more attention to things, actual things, than other voters. And many of them can still remember when a president actually led, was coherent, was honest. So there is a vulnerability there. Number two, the president's entire approach to the coronavirus increasingly is that senior citizens are expendable. They are the ones who are the most vulnerable. Therefore, they have been the ones who have been most focused on the failures of this. Or am I overthinking this? Is it something else?
Well, you know, Trump's numbers are pretty bad everywhere, but you're right. There's a spike against normalcy here. And I don't know. You could find it out with data. I'm sure the campaigns are. I would guess something akin to you. One, seniors, having been around a long time, have a point of reference of what a president is that goes back a couple. And so the distance we've traveled in the behavior of the institution, or at least the person inside it, they have a feel for, because they've seen a normalcy that younger generations that have only had this pop culture presidency between kind of the good one with Obama and now the train wreck one with Trump, you know, maybe not have that reference. So I think that's going on. Second, look, there's no doubt, and we know in the medical science that we're quickly building herd immunity with people under 45. All the trouble in this virus, or not all of it, but overwhelmingly statistically, is over like 55. So, and particularly over 65. So if you're a senior, you know that there is an old people killing virus out there, and the guy in the White House wearing the clown shoes saying drink Clorox and Pine Sol is not the answer to the problem. So it's back to, at least in my opinion or my guess, what I was talking about before, which is the stakes of politics have risen from cable TV, reality show, you know, cheesy entertainment, to life or death, and nowhere more than in the cohort of people, you know, who are over 60. So I think that's where the cutting edge of the virus is biologically, and that's where the president's incompetence has hurt him the most politically.
So the other interesting story politically, I think, is, you know, is out of the Republican caucus in the U.S. Senate, where they had a lunch with Trump. And the word that basically comes out of this lunch is we're all in with Trump. We're going to do his bidding. There's not going to be any disagreements anymore. We all rise or fall together. So they made this decision that they are going to just cling as tightly to Trump as possible. And this includes all of the vulnerables, you know, the McSallys, the Joni Ernst, the Cory Gardners, everybody across the board. Now, under a certain level, that's a rational decision, right? That you know, might as well, that given the fact that we're so tribalized, so polarized, there's not going to be a lot of ticket splitting. And so if they break with Trump, they basically hurt him, but they hurt themselves. But I mean, Jesus.
Yeah, I know. It is the Parliament of Courage, you know. I'm sure the ghosts of members of Congress past want to appear and say, hey, you know what we had to deal with? We had to leave Congress to land on Anzio Beach. You know, you gutless cowards. But I understand the politics of it. You know, I've been the fool on the Hill on this for a while. I was saying 2 years ago, this guy's going to cost us the Senate. It's going to be bad. And the problem is they're going to wait till the last minute, and then it'll be too late to do anything. And then they're wiggle on the hook a little and die. So here we are. They're in the lifeboat. You know, they really have nowhere else to go. And so they're going to bet on Trump magic, and they're going to know in their hearts it's a foolhardy bet. And they're going to hope that a big Trump negative campaign, that Biden will show up wearing diapers and goo goo gaga his way through the campaign. And there will be a few bad days for Biden where they're all going to think that's going to work. But they've cast their lot. And now the great punishing god of ironic karma is going to clip a bunch of these folks. And the truth is, even if you're Cory Gardner, who has been, you know, I'm sure his security code name is Mr. Tungsten, because he's had so much strength on the Trump issue. even if you were to jump out right now and say, you know, I never liked that Trump guy, got a lot of differences, I'm an independent voice, too late. Too late. That path is gone. It might have worked for him 18 months ago to kind of build that argument and show it. But no. So he's going to get mowed down. Even though there are a lot of pretty normal Republican winnable states here, we're not going to have, thanks to Trump, normal Republican numbers, and we're going to take Senate losses. And so the Ernst of the world are actually in some vulnerability. The Gardners, in my view, are gone. Collins, you know, the obvious places, just there's going to be a 30-foot wall at tidal wave coming. And unless Biden really works hard every day to lose, which is not impossible, maybe he bungles the VP pick, you know, falls asleep in the debate, a lot of stuff happens. But the probabilities are now very bad for most of these Republican senators. And it's really possible if the election were held today, I think they'd probably grab the Senate, which is
grim. When I go back and I said that I actually understand the sort of the twisted logic here, because one obvious thing is if you're going to be an ex-senator, at least have some pride, at least know that you didn't go down in complete disgrace. But the other calculation is that no matter what happens in November, Trumpism is still going to be around in the Republican Party. And you know that if you bailed on Donald Trump and he loses this election, you're going to be persona non grata in the Republican Party, in those Republican circles, for a very, very long time. And they do understand that. So that's in some ways, it's an acknowledgement that the Republican Party is just not going to snap back to normalcy, even if Trump gets trounced.
Though I'll tell you, I mean, I agree. I think that's totally their calculus. Trump has a godlike control over primary voters. So I've just got to, you know, I'm secretly in the Vichy underground. I just haven't been able to make any of the meetings. So I'm going to quietly campaign against Trump in the key battlefield of my mind. But I'll tell you, I'm a contrarian on this other point. There is a presumption, it may well be true, that after Trump is dragged kicking and screaming out of the White House, should he lose, that Trump will still rule the Republican Party. I think he's going to be like a 300-pound tuna that's going to rot quickly. He will try. He'll set up the MAGA patriots. He'll try to disqualify the election as a big fraud deal. And his hangout in the rally with the loaded Slurpee crowd will agree with it for a while. But it's got some weaknesses. One, a guy who built his brand of being Mr. Winner is going to be the world's biggest loser. That's bad kryptonite. Two, he won't get covered like he used to. Right now, they'll cover anything he says. Moon is made of green cheese. It leads to news because he's president of the United States. I think there will even be an overreaction where the media feeling guilty will, because, you know, they're all out to murder him, will try to shut that down. And he'll have one streaming network. And Trump will be old and a loser and fighting more legal trouble. And so I think the idea that Trump will be anything like he is right now, you know, 9 months after the election is actually incorrect, and it'll compound in the other way. But I'm only guessing, and I've been wrong about Trump before. But that's my instinct.
I strongly hope that you are correct about this. Let me give you a contrarian dystopian alternative vision.
Okay, cool.
He loses the election, but of course it was stolen from him. He was stabbed in the back. It was terrible luck. It was a Democrat who have thrown him out of office, and he is still the legitimate leader of the movement. So he builds the grievance movement around the stab in the back theory. He stays highly visible, fighting this as long as possible. So the after the election is like, imagine Bush versus Gore, if Gore never conceded and never went away. This becomes the theme on Fox News or his own news network, One America Network. And because nothing stopped him from running for a second term running again in 2024, he says, I want the restoration. So it's going to be transition to restoration. So here's my question, Mr. Murphy. Mm-hmm. Which Republican would challenge him in a primary and is capable of beating him in 2024?
That is a great question.
We should have started drinking before we got to
Then I'd have a real Wink Martindale. It would be right now they'd all think they can't. But if he does turn into the rotting carcass of the 300-pound tuna, and it's got some energy, but it's kind of like Fall of Romanovs. You know, he's got 100 people sitting around him in a Paris apartment, you know, and still treat him like king. Then I think the Tom Cottons of the world, who are incredibly ambitious and comfortable with populist conservative stuff, will sense danger and try to make a run for it. Now, he's not my favorite, but he's kind of an archetype of one bunch. Ted Cruz will never give up. Marco Rubio. There may be another new kind of interesting. It's hard for, of course, Nikki Haley would drink Clorox herself if she thought it would make her president. So she would be more than happy to knife him in turn, and the media would give her a run on identity. So I think there are no shortages of people that right now don't think it's plausible. But if they smell rot on Trump. Remember, he'll take the institutional Republican hostages, will then pivot. They were all secretly against Trump. And the rage in the economic heart of the Republican Party, if the Democrats get the House and the Senate and Biden abandons his centerism, is going to be incredible. And Trump will take the blame for that. So it'll be situational, but there's no shortage of ambition among the Haleys and Cottons and even older names like the Rubios or Cruises. So if he shows weakness, the hyenas will be upon him, I believe.
Well, and of course, the narrative on the right will change completely under a Biden presidency. So let's just imagine if Biden wins the presidency and Democrats take the Senate and then decide to push a really aggressive agenda, you know that brings the conservatives, back. This is now their sweet spot. This is what they do best. They're in opposition. They have no responsibility anymore. Right. So they can pivot to that and get some of the, post-Trump, rather than, be Trumpian water carriers, they could suddenly pretend once again to, care about health care or the deficit.
Yeah, they'd have a new enemy.
Instead of Trump's enemies. Exactly. It will feel more normal, won't it?
Right, right. It'll usurp kind of the Trump, and there'll be Trump fatigue. And remember, if he loses, it's not likely to be 18 votes. It's likely to be 4 million nationally. He loses Florida, the most overrated Trump state. He loses, of course, Pennsylvania, Michigan, probably loses Arizona and North Carolina.
You think he's going to lose Florida?
Yeah, I think the biggest, and I've done a lot. I did both of Jeb's successful governor's races, a lot more down there. I know Florida pretty well. This idea that Trump has Florida locked. No, if Trump's in trouble in Michigan and Pennsylvania and Arizona, he's also going to be in trouble in Florida, just one click less. So, yeah, I think if the cookie crumbles, it'll crumble big, which will compound the rotten tuna scenario. But we'll see.
I love the rotten tuna scenario. Okay, so you mentioned before if Biden, of course, could blow this, including by bungling the VP pick. What would a bungled VP pick look like to you?
I love this question, and I'm contrarian about it. The great model of doing it right is Clinton, who decided, all right, nobody votes for vice president, so what is my pitch? Young, generational change, New South moderate Democrat. So I'm going to pick me. Just a weaker version of me, so there's no daylight. So we went out and got another Southern white Protestant new Democrat, Al Gore, and it was one pitch for the ticket and worked like a charm. When you pick differences, then the debate becomes about the difference between you and your opponent. What you ought to do is minimize risk. So the key to the election, if you have to boil it down to one thing, is a combination of keep it on Trump and hold the suburbs. We've lost the suburbs full of Republican and independent college-educated white women, and that's why the Republican Party has gotten its clock cleaned in the last couple of big elections after Trump. So play defense there. Tactically, be very aggressive on Trump, much more than they're being now, but strategically, be careful. So that means because he said a woman, Klobuchar, Gretchen Whitmer, I can make a great governing argument for my favorite Democratic governor, Gia Raimondo in Rhode Island. She doesn't do anything politically, but she's a great sign of sober fiscal governing once Biden gets in there and deals with the trillions and the hole we're going to be. But the public employee unions don't like her. She was for Bloomberg in the primary. I don't think she'd realistically pick. The dangerous thing is Biden turns internal and says, my problem is African-American or other minority enthusiasm. Well, I would say from the primary, no African-American candidate could even stay in long enough to challenge him. So I don't think he has that problem. And if he picks a Kamala Harris or Stacey Abrams, there's a lot of risk. Abrams is the better candidate than Harris. Harris was a bad candidate. Really? People just can't seem to say that. Her campaign was a train wreck. The only good day she had was when she ripped Biden's face off with kind of a cheap shot, which I'm sure Biden remembers. You pick her, then Trump's going to be in the slave reparation business for a month. And, you're gonna have that because Trump's a racist and he'll use despicable tactics. So I say eliminate the risk. Go with the Amys or the Whitmers, maybe the governor of New Mexico. And play to have a VP that supports you but can get out of the way and doesn't diminish you by being a better star than you are. That is the way to go. But I think the pressure is on him to go with Kamala or somebody on the theory of we've got to excite our base. I think Trump excites their base. Biggest problem we've got, and this is a bugaboo of mine, is the obsession with bases.
Okay,
you
I agree
with this,
by the
way. Base in pain. That's how you win.
Yeah. From the Democratic point of view, what more do you need to inspire you than Donald Trump? I mean, seriously. I mean,
yes, exactly.
I do not understand that. So you need one more left-wing policy proposal. That will get you excited, but not the prospect of 4 years of Donald Trump, really.
Yeah, I mean, I think there could be some rifle shot policy at young kids in the focus groups. You know, the Biden campaign, I don't think they do, but they can't assume that everybody knows the great Joe Biden story. They don't. And young voters say corporate Democrat, which is poison. So there's got to be a little bit of policy talk there. But the main thing is don't scare the suburbs away. Don't give Trump a handle with policy or a VP pick or anything like that to change the topic of the election to Biden. Keep it on Trump. You keep it on Trump, you win. So careful. Tactically, you rip Trump's face off every day, and they need to be doing a lot more of that. But strategically, the big stuff, don't give Trump a handle.
Mike Murphy, thanks for coming back on the Bulwark Podcast. It has been a pleasure, as always.
My friend, always a hoot. I love this podcast, and I appreciate it. And I promised I would plug, if you don't mind, I do something at USC, University of Southern California. It's called the Center for the Political Future, and we have a lot of cool Zoom discussions on politics and stuff like that. Bob Strum, the great retired Democrat, is the director. I'm co-director, and we have a lot of fun there, so you can check it out online.
And, of course, your podcast, Hacks on Tap with David Axelrod.
Yeah, we enjoy that. We had Rahm Emanuel on. It was like the Tasmanian Devil last week. It was so much fun. And he is smart. It's fun to watch him and Axe, because Axe is kind of a center-left Democrat, and Rahm's a center Democrat, kind of wrestle a little bit. So if you're going to listen to one episode of Hacks on Tap, I would recommend last week.
I have that queued up for my next dog walk. And since we have a three-day weekend, I will do it. And for everybody else, enjoy your three-day weekend. If you still understand the concept of weekends, if you actually figured out that today is Friday or whatever the day happens to be when you're listening to this. And we will be back on Tuesday, and we will do this all over again.